Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, committed to a California where all low-income workers have the power to advance economically. Learn more at irvine.org. The California Endowment. Health happens when Californians value schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org. And by the California Healthcare Foundation, helping low-income Californians get the health care they need. On the web at chcf.org.
From Valley Public Radio, you're listening to Valley Edition. Today on our show, what role do Merle Haggard and Buck Owens play in the arc of country music history? We talked to filmmaker Ken Burns about his latest project on this uniquely American art form. I'm Alice Daniel.
And I'm Carrie Klein. We also meet a mayor who's canvassing his small city to help parents access a very non-traditional preschool. And we introduce you to a Los Angeles podcast about earthquakes and tell you about some upcoming CSU summer arts concerts in Fresno.
But first, let's turn to politics. Fresno City Councilmember Esmeralda Soria says she's running against Representative Jim Costa for the state's 16th congressional district. Meanwhile, David Valadeo filed yesterday to run against Representative T.J. Cox. In 2018, Cox defeated Valadeo for the 21st congressional seat by less than 1,000 votes. Moderator Kathleen Schock gets the latest from political science professor Lisa Bryant from Fresno State and Ivy A.M. Cargyle from CSU Bakersfield, as well as GV Wire News director and columnist Bill McEwen and Bakersfield Californian columnist Robert Price.
Well, first of all, thank you all for joining us today. Let's just dive in and talk about the recent announcement that David Valadeo was going to be participating in a rematch against T.J. Cox, a race that he narrowly lost in 2018. So, Robert, as I understand, you broke this story in the Bakersfield Californian, and you've talked to both campaigns. What are you hearing from them about Valadeo's decision to jump back into this race again?
Well, I don't think anybody's surprised. I don't think we should be surprised that David Valadeo is jumping back in. I mean, that was an incredibly close, exciting race between the two of them. Exciting for the rest of us, maybe not so much for David. But it was so close that he really had to give it another shot. T.J. Cox, I don't know that he's really had an opportunity to show himself very much. He's only been in just a few months, but we shouldn't be surprised.
And Ivy, you know, I'm curious, from where you're sitting, what do you think are going to be the issues that drive this campaign? Do you think it will be a issue-oriented campaign, or are we running the risk of a campaign that's going to devolve into personal attacks?
I think it can be an issue-oriented campaign. Part of what T.J. Cox was successful in doing in 2018 was, and of course a lot of candidates were able to do this, was the nationalization of the midterm elections, right? And Cox was very successful because he got a lot of money from the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee. He was able to successfully tie Donald Trump to David Valadeo. And so because there is such a large, because the 21st district has such a large Latinx voter base, I think that really did resonate with the Latinx community. I mean, they're at 72% of the population of the 21st congressional district. So if T.J. Cox is able to do that again, he can go through the issues with immigration and the economy and jobs and just go through and just connect connect Valadeo to Trump. Cox has a chance of winning this again.
I'm exactly correct. That's exactly what Cox is going to do. And he might even have more success at doing that than he did last time because the president has continued, sort of on the same pace he was before.
But exactly. The last time they were up against each other, Valadeo kept his distance from Trump. But yet, I believe it was last week he was seen at an event with Mike Pence. Do you think that's going to change?
He'll continue to keep his distance for sure. But he's in a position now where he has to he wants to make it clear that he's running. And here's the vice president. So I guess it makes sense. But I think in the future we'll see him keep his distance.
Valadeo can keep his distance all he wants. However, what I thought was really interesting, particularly in the Spanish language ads, part of what hurt Valadeo in 2018 is that I don't think he thought that Cox really had a chance, because if you look at previous outcomes, the people he beat out by double digits. he had double-digit leads on them. And so I think that, you know, while he tried to distance himself from Trump and try to make it clear to the commute to the electorate that he wasn't, he didn't agree with all of the positions, the voting record, Cost was able to successfully show Valadao's voting record in his commercials and in his campaign speeches. And so that's what ended up tying Valadao to Trump, regardless of how much distance Valadao tried to put between the two.
Now, both candidates have faced ethical issues over the last year or so. Cox for not properly declaring business interests on financial disclosure forms. And then Valadao's family farm was seized in the summer of 2018 for failure to pay back more than $8 million in loans. Do you think those are going to be prevailing issues in this campaign, or do you think the voters are pretty much over that?
Well, I think we'll unfortunately hear more about it. I mean, that's just the nature of this. The stakes are so high. I think we'll see some of that type of campaigning.
I agree. I think that's where I think that's probably where the negativity is going to start, because it's not as personal as going directly towards someone's personality. But if they both have issues, so I think it's going to end up being fair game, and we're going to learn a lot more than we wanted to about this.
So I know we're very early in this election. Does anyone have any predictions to make?
I think that Cox has a chance. I think that he needs to, because there is a good percentage of Latino, Latina, Latinx voters, Black voters, and Asian American voters combined. I think that if he is strategic and he is authentic and he mobilizes these communities, he has a chance to win this again, even though, as was previously stated, that he hasn't necessarily had a chance to show his record or show any work that he's done. If he can mobilize the community, I think he has a chance.
Robert,
I think that's a good, that's a good analysis. I agree. I don't think the president has done David Valadao any favors here. Not to say he can't do it. You know, he's a likable guy. He had a pretty good record, I thought, in Congress. So, you know, if he can focus on that, he might be able to pull it out. But I would say the edge goes to Cox at this point.
Great. Well, thank you both so much. If I could have you just stay on hold for a minute while we switch gears and talk about the 16th Congressional District, which covers Fresno, Merced, and Madera counties. Jim Costa, has held off Republican challengers for 14 years in this district. But recently, Fresno Councilmember Esmeralda Soria has announced that she will challenge Costa next year. Bill McEwen, you've been covering politics for a long time. You've been covering Costa for a long time. In the Fresno Bee, in the headline, question, could this be the greatest challenge or threat that Costa has ever faced? Do you think that's a fair assessment?
Well, they asked the question. I don't think it's the strongest challenger that Costa's ever faced. And what's interesting about this is Costa and Soria both being Democrats, and all the discussion about this so far, there's presumption somehow that it's going to be Costa and Soria in the runoff, when, to my eyes, there's absolutely no chance of that happening. And even though the Republican in the race is little known at all, people are overlooking the fact that about 42% of the district's Republican, and Soria's challenge, what that has accomplished is that the Republican candidate, Mr. Cookingham, is going to make it to the runoff. And I don't hear anybody talking about that. So this matchup will be decided in the primary.
So it's interesting. I'm glad you brought up the other candidates. There's Republican Kevin Cookingham, a retired educator from Clovis, as well as another Democrat, Kim Williams, who was a part of the State Department under the Obama administration. Lisa Bryant, I'd like to turn it to you. Getting to this question of the Republican opposition, do you think this is a race where we could see the Republican Party perhaps bring in a stronger candidate or invest a significant amount of money to flip the seat?
Well, I think obviously they're going to want to bring in somebody, especially with what they're going to perceive as a three-way race between the Democrats that are going to split those votes. I think that they see they can at least guarantee a place on the ballot. I don't know if that's true. I mean, Fresno County has recently adopted the Voter Choice Act, which means every registered voter, regardless of party, is going to get a ballot in the mail. And so 42% of registered voters are Republican, but you're going to have, you know, 60%, 58% who aren't. And so it really depends on who returned those ballots. I don't think it's a guarantee that we're going to have a two-party runoff. I think that you could end up with, you know, Costa and Soria. Cunningham and Williams also have to overcome name recognition, right? Soria and Costa are well-known names in households. And so people, you know, it's almost like a brand. People vote what they know. And that's sort of one of the big challenges for the Republicans, certainly, but Williams as well. And so I think it'll be interesting to see what happens.
Bill, I'm curious what your thoughts are around Soria's motivation here. You know, she is safe in her city council seat until 2022. So she doesn't have a lot to lose here. Do you think she is really in this to win, or is she setting herself up for the next big race?
No, she's very much wants to win the race. And the fact that it's a safe race for her, in other words, there's a seat that she can continue if she loses, that increases the appeal for her. She's very ambitious politically and has been mulling a lot of options. For example, her name was floated for the mayor's race. Ultimately, she decided not to get in, and maybe she waited too long. Once Andrew Janz was in, does that really leave room for her? Of course, she waited to see what happened with Juan Arambula's trial, because if Mr. Arambula had been convicted, certainly she would want to go for that assembly seat. So I think some of the doors narrowed for her, and she decided to go against Jim Costa. What's interesting to me is she's running as this progressive, and all of a sudden she's leaning further left because she wants to distance herself from Jim Costa. But the fact of the matter is, she so far in her career has been very much a blue dog Democrat, and I'm sure she would not like to be reminded of that fact. So that's really interesting to me, and we're going to see what happens. Another challenge I see for Soria is this. I think she's relatively unaware of the demands of a congressional campaign. And so as a sitting city council member with many responsibilities to that office, how is she going to manage the last 45 days when she needs to be at 10 different places in a given day, Saturdays and Sundays as well? And so that's going to be interesting to me, because if she misses city council meetings, if she misses key votes, the Costa campaign is going to be bringing that up in force.
You know, I'm glad. I want to get back to the point that you made about her perceived progressiveness. Lisa, could you speak to Costa's record as a very conservative Democrat? How much is that hurting him in terms of the future of his political future?
Well, Costa has long been in political science what we call sort of the median member of Congress, right? He's essentially the most centrist member in terms of his votes in Congress. And so I think that Esmeralda can use that against him, saying that, you know, there are people in his district who are being left behind. Actually, a very similar narrative that Elizabeth Heng used when she ran in 2018. And I think that Soria, again, similar to what Ivy was saying in Bakersfield, there's a large Latino-Latina community that she can say Acosta's not serving, right? That we have these poor, we have people who are being left behind. Acosta, as sort of that centrist member of Congress, has not been bringing back a lot of pork or good sort of policy changes to help those communities. And so I think that that's going to be the narrative that we should expect to see out of Soria. And I think that she has positioned herself, whether you want to call her sort of left of center or blue dot Democrat or whatever, she's positioned herself in a place where she can say, look, I'm working with these people already in Fresno. I know how to bring success to these communities. And she can use that against Costa.
We just have a few seconds left. Go ahead, Bill, make the final comment.
So in politics, I've seen it happen time and time again. People just get tired of somebody, and they just say that person has served their time, and they don't need any rationale behind that. And they decide, oh, and this one, Costi's had his day. I'm going with the newcomer.
Robert Price, Ivy Cargyle, Bill McEwen, and Lisa Bryant, thank you so much for being with us on Valley Edition.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Carrie Klein. And now we're going to introduce you to a mayor who wants his small city of Fowler to be at the forefront of education. That's why he spends his time outside of city council and running his own auto mechanic shop, urging families who can't afford preschool to consider an alternative. Valley Public Radio's Laura Satsui tells us about this at-home program that's piloting in Fresno County.
You see that? The oil for this one is that one that is motocraft over there, Mercon 5.
Mayor David Cardenas points to a car in his shop and tells an employee to change the oil. Then he washes his hands, changes his mechanic's shirt, and heads out. But it's no ordinary lunch break. He's passing out flyers.
Good morning.
Hi.
Outside of a flower shop.
And we're here because I'm trying to bring this program, but I want to make sure that it's going to be a program for young little kids.
Inside a Presbyterian church.
I came to see you at your office to give you some flyers that I'm distributing to the whole city.
Oh, okay.
And outside the senior center.
Good morning, Mr. and Mrs. Chavez. How are you guys doing?
Yeah.
And it's about a program that I'm trying to bring to help young couples, young families, to help their kids, teaching them preschool classes.
The program is called Upstart. It was developed by the Utah legislature in collaboration with a tech and education company called Waterford.org back in 2009. The pilot program in Fresno County is funded by the Audacious Project, which is the philanthropic side to TED, which also makes TED Talks. Here's how it works. Families commit to working with their child for 15 minutes a day, 5 days a week, on the Upstart computer program. The one-year curriculum is a mix of subjects, including reading, math, and science.
I'm working hard because I know the great benefit that this represents to the parents, you know, these young kids, so they can be better prepared. So when they start their kindergarten classes, they're a regular age of five, I believe, then those kids are going to be very successful, as the statistics shows that they're way ahead.
There are some independent studies that back Cardenas up, showing that kids who've participated in Upstart are more prepared for kindergarten than those who have no preschooling. This year, Upstart will provide 200 local families with free access to the program. Cardenas wants Fowler to be well represented, with at least 50 families. So far, he's signed up about 20, including Maggie Regalado. As she pushes her 3-year-old daughter, Victoria, on a swing in the city park, she says she can teach her some basic skills.
But I know that in the school system now, they use computers a lot, so I felt that she would be getting both ways of learning, and she'd be more prepared once she starts school.
Regalado says she's trying to strike a balance when it comes to screen time.
I can't tell her, Victoria, put your device down when mommy has it attached to her too. So I just try to limit what she's able to watch or not access on her tablet.
Professor Pei-Ying Wu at Fresno State's Kremen School of Education and Human Development says she sees Upstart's value.
I admire their intention of helping children who don't have access to high-quality early education by providing some sort of online intervention or online instruction for them to develop their vocabulary.
But she says the program doesn't address another important facet of early education.
The most important thing for preschoolers to learn at preschool is how to interact with others. Because when they go to kindergarten, they have to learn how to follow the routine, how to follow the instruction, how to learn with their peers.
And an interactive social environment is not something an app can provide. Wu also wonders, will this help kids fall in love with learning? Cardenas thinks yes.
It's something that is going to serve them well when they start their kindergarten classes. That level, those kids are going to be more knowledgeable, more experienced. And what I also believe that they will be more self-confidence.
He's hosting one more informational meeting this Saturday, with the hopes of giving more families who can't pay for preschool an option that is far from traditional. With Valley Public Radio, I'm Laura Satsui.
You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Alice Daniel. Renowned PBS filmmaker Ken Burns will visit the Valley next week as part of a national tour to preview and discuss his most recent long-form documentary, Country Music. The Ken Burns Country Music Roadshow will make stops July 25th at the Soroyan Theater in Fresno and July 26th at the Fox Theater in Bakersfield. I spoke with Burns about the role the San Joaquin Valley plays in what composer Harlan Howard described as three chords and the truth. You're likely the most well-known documentary filmmaker in the U.S. with more than 30 exhaustively reported and researched films under your belt, including ones on baseball, the Vietnam War, and jazz. Was country music an obvious next choice for you?
Well, you know, these projects take many, many years. Vietnam took 10 and a half years to make. Our one on the history of the Second World War took 7 years. The national parks took 10 as well. So there's a lot of overlap. I knew I was going to be doing country music back in 2010. Early 2011, when we had barely started shooting the Vietnam film. So many of these are overlapping for many, many years. So it's not like the next thing is the perfect thing. It's that the story of country music is a perfect subject. I'm in the business of telling stories. My stories happen to be in American history, but that's the way a painter might choose oil as opposed to watercolor, choose to do still lifes instead of landscapes. I choose to do stuff in American history, but it's all stories.
Out of the 16 and a half hours of storytelling we get with country music, what's a story that just sticks with you, something you can't stop thinking about?
Well, you know, it's interesting, and it's germane to my conversation with you and to your audience, and that's Merle Haggard. I knew about him. I knew his centrality to the music, but I didn't know how important it was. And then as we began to research the details of his remarkable story, we were very fortunate. Out of the 101 interviews that we did for the series, probably 80 of them are in the film. 20 have passed away, including Merle, but we were so fortunate to get him before he passed away. And his wisdom and his insights and his thoughtfulness about what a good story and a good song mean, and he's one of the great singer-songwriters of all time, regardless of genre, and what some of the early influences he had. So he's equally as effective talking about the Maddox Brothers and Rose, also from the Central Valley, talking about Lefty Frizzell, talking about various people who were inspirations for him. Bob Wills and his Texas Playboys in the days of the 30s country western swing.
Well, I'm glad you brought up Bob Wills. He was a fiddle player with his band, the Texas Playboys. They blended jazz horn sections and swing rhythms with traditional fiddle music into a style that became known as western swing. He moved to Fresno with his band at the height of his popularity to be closer to Hollywood and to own a horse ranch. For people who aren't familiar with his music, how significant was he as an artist?
Oh, he's really important, and he helps to remind people who may not know about country music. They may love it or they may hate it, but they may not know that much about its history, that it's never been one thing. The Big Bang, as country music folks refer to the creation of it, occurs in the summer of 27 when an entrepreneur named Ralph Peer records in successive weeks the Carter family, which is the epitome of home and mother and the church, the kind of Sunday morning values, and then Jimmy Rogers the next week, who is most definitely a rogue and a scamp and bringing the blues out of the deep, deep South, who's very much Saturday night. And to which then country music expanded even further and did cowboy stuff, did western swing, did the Bakersfield sound as it emerged, did bluegrass and other string evolutions. And so it's never been one thing. And I think we have to understand that swing music was the soundtrack of America. I think jazz swing represented 75% of all records sold in the 30s and early 40s. And so what you see is that country music is ever adapting. And Bob Wills out of Texas wanted to swing in Oklahoma, wanted to swing the way Louis Armstrong and Chick Webb and Fletcher Henderson and Duke Ellington and Benny Goodman and others were swinging in jazz. And he just came from different roots, so he added different instruments, but the rhythm, the propulsion is the same. And it shows you that all of our categorizing, all of the boundaries between different categories don't actually exist to the musicians. I mean, you've got people who are influenced by the jazz stylings of Django Reinhardt, like Chester Atkins, the great guitar player who came to Nashville with the Carter family. You've got Willie Nelson, who still phrases unlike anyone else in country music and owes more to jazz. So jazz, rhythm and blues, the blues, country, rock and roll, they are all so intertwined.
I'm curious, what are some of the similar roots that jazz and country music share?
They share the kind of conversation that African Americans and other European Americans have been having in the South for centuries. The banjo, the classic instrument of an early country band, is an African instrument. The fiddle is, of course, from Europe and the British Isles. And so that conversation between the traditions of the Scotch, Irish, Welsh, English ballads and the blues are very much intertwined in country music. So you would take some of the earlier celebrated heroes of it, A.P. Carter of the Carter family, Jimmy Rogers, who I just described, Hank Williams, the great, perhaps the greatest of all country people, Johnny Cash, and Bill Monroe, the founder of bluegrass music. Every single one of those men had an African-American mentor who took their chops from here to up here, and it's reflected in the music. So it's a wonderful story to tell because it reminds us that at the heart of this are people who are hungry. What's so surprising is that everybody, whether it's Merle Haggard or Buck Owens or the Maddox Brothers and Rose, are coming from abject poverty, not just Depression-era poverty, but poverty before the Depression and after the Depression. Dolly Parton's father paid the doctor who came to the holler to deliver her in East Tennessee with a sack of cornmeal. I mean, she was on TV before her family could own a TV.
Let's return to Buck Owens and Merle Haggard. Their music was often dramatically different. What for you defines the Bakersfield sound, and how do you think Buck and Merle differ from each other?
Well, that's a really wonderful question. I think it's got a kind of a driving beat. It's a post-war sound that's got some insistence to it. It's electrified. It's a little bit different from, and sometimes a lot different from the smoother sound that Nashville was producing at the time. And so it's got an edge. And even though Buck Owens isn't talking about the things, his voice, as Dwight Yoakam, another inheritor of that in our film, describes, the voice has an insistence. You know, tiger by the tail. I've got a tiger by the tail. It's plain to see, you know, and it goes on like that. Merle is called the poet of the common man. Like Hank Williams, who is the hillbilly Shakespeare, Merle understands about life. And so the songs that he writes are from his own experience, some of prison, some of the loneliness that came from that, from heartbreak, from rediscovering love. All of that is an important part of his. And so I think there's more heartache, obvious heartache in Merle's work, even though Buck has got all of that defiance in it. He's singing, as Dwight says in our film, for every Okie, every Arkie, every Texan that came to the Central Valley and was, you know, discriminated against all under the moniker Okies when they first arrived.
When we talk about the Bakersfield sound, was it just the result of children of the Dust Bowl migration, or was something else at work?
I think there's always lots of things at play, but I think certainly the experiences of the Dust Bowl, the diaspora that it created of hundreds of thousands of Americans. Remember, there was a drought in 46 of the 48 states, so everybody was called an Okie, whether they came from Oklahoma or not, and they all migrated to what they thought would be the promised land, and of course ran into a desire not to welcome new immigrants. Sounds familiar. And that just repeats itself over and over again. So I think that experience, and let's remember this is during the Depression, so it's the poverty combined with the ecological disaster of the Dust Bowl combined with this migration that is going to be helpful in it. But it's also, as I said, a kind of post-World War II demand for something new, the beginning of electrification, the honky-tonks and the roadhouses that are filling the Central Valley and the oil production that's going on there. So you're having a different kind of demand.
So you mentioned sort of the evolution of all these genres. I'm wondering if rock and roll is one of your next documentaries.
Well, you know, I've thought about that, and people have asked me to do rock and roll for a long time, even before I did A History of Jazz that came out in 2001. I don't think so right now. I mean, I was really content to take jazz and spend many, many years working on that, and then to spend 8 or so years working on country music. But never say never, you know.
As you've said, country music is very much about storytelling, driven in part by the tensions that have shaped American history itself. While the storytelling makes it relatable, I wonder if it's also the storytelling that pigeonholes it for some people who don't understand its breadth and its influence.
Well, I think it gets pigeonholed because of snobbery. I think people say, oh, country music is, you know, just a minor art form. And it doesn't have the sophistication and the complication of classical music or some forms of jazz. But the composer, Harlan Howard, called country music three chords and the truth. That means there's a kind of elemental musical form to it, just as there is in the blues, just as there is in folk music, just as there is in rock and roll. But you can hear the lyrics, and what are they about? All relatable things.
Let's talk about Merle Haggard's biggest commercial hit, which was Okie from Muskogee. It was often seen as a counter-protest to the anti-war movement, and yet Haggard in his later years was open that he smoked marijuana and he spoke out against America's overseas wars. How significant was that song politically, and does it speak to some contradictions in country music?
Well, I think there's contradictions in everybody and in everything everywhere. Nobody is ever one thing. And I think for me, growing up in Ann Arbor, Michigan in the 1960s, we loved Okie from Muskogee for its kind of meta meaning. You know, we laughed at it. What we learned later was that, of course, Merle and everybody on his bus smoked marijuana, and that was just inspired. It did get appropriated by the counter movement to the counterculture, so that the anti-Vietnam War movement sparred a response to them, not so much because they supported the war, but they didn't like what the hippies were doing. So when it got appropriated, then Merle kind of got, you know, grooved and pegged as this, but he outgrew it. He had already outgrown it. He'd transcended it. He was already the poet of the common man, and that was important. And I'm so happy that at the end of his life, he began to talk about the song in relationship to being proud of where you're from. Let's remember that while he's born in California, his family were Okies. And so I think we begin to see that quite often country music is a voice of people who don't feel like their stories are being told. And what's the genius of Merle Haggard is that he takes those stories and makes them universal. And I'm so happy that we're going to be able to be in Fresno and Bakersfield to sort of celebrate his and Buck's and the Maddox brothers and Rose and Bob Wills and Dwight Yoakam's legacy of understanding what the contribution of the Central Valley, what the contribution of the Bakersfield sound has made to not just country music, but to American music, world music, full stop, period.
Well, that sounds like a good place to end. Ken Burns, it's been a real honor to speak with you today. Thanks a lot.
Oh, my pleasure. Thanks so much. Can't wait to see you all.
Again, Ken Burns and his Country Music Roadshow will be at the Saroyan Theater in Fresno, July 25th, and the Fox Theater in Bakersfield, July 26th.
This is Valley Edition. I'm Carrie Klein. Earthquakes have been on many Californians' minds recently, ever since two big quakes jolted Central California over Independence Day weekend. We thought this would be a good time to introduce you to a new podcast out of KPCC in Los Angeles called The Big One, all about preparing for that huge quake that could devastate Southern California. Here's a clip from the trailer.
What are we preparing for? when we prepare for an earthquake.
Definitely there will be the perception that the ground is literally waving in front of you.
And then I remember hearing bigger chunks of bricks falling onto the bus.
I knew exactly what was happening. I remember thinking, okay, this is an earthquake. It feels like a big one.
There will be 1,800 dead.
The Big One is part first-person narrative, part survival guide, and joining me today to talk about it is lead producer Misha Youssef. Early on, you'll hear Misha mention the name Arwen. That's Arwen Nix, her executive producer.
So we wanted to figure out, how do we tell the story in a way that doesn't just feel like vegetables and instead compels people to act? One of the things that draws both me and Arwen together as storytellers is our desire to create impact, to make stories that move people physically, but also in terms of making their lives better. So in order to do that, we went out and we talked to a lot of people. We did a lot of man on the street interviews to figure out, like, what is it that people want to hear? And we found that most people who were prepared were not afraid, and most people who were afraid were not prepared. And so we knew at some point we wanted to help people prepare, and that's kind of where the Your Survival Guide aspect of the show came in. As far as the fictional narrative, that was largely driven by a conversation that we had with Dr. Sarah McBride. Specifically, Arwen spoke to this sociologist who works for the USGS, who was there in Christchurch, New Zealand, and discovered that in order to impact people to act and prepare for a big disaster, you have to put them in the shoes of the person actually experiencing the earthquake. So you have to speak to them in second person. You are going to experience this. You need to do this. And so from that finding and talking to people, we kind of started to come up with the realization that we had to blend in fiction and use all of the reporting, especially from the 2008 shakeout report, to construct a fiction narrative to help people be more in the position of what would actually happen if a big earthquake struck Southern California.
And it's really interesting that you say that you found that people in general, or at least those who are prepared, are not afraid. I mean, I was very surprised, actually, when I listened to this, about how serious the podcast is. It is a very serious subject matter, of course. But, you know, it seems like this maybe partially explains, you know, that it was kind of deliberate for you to take this tone that was very serious and kind of scary at times.
Yeah, you know, it's funny. We've been accused of some fear-mongering. I have to say that the earthquake scenario, when you read the shakeout report for the San Andreas, best case scenario, the most conservative scenario, is very scary. 1,800 people are expected to die. You know, there's expected to be $200 billion in damage to Southern California. There will be 1,200 fires, maybe even more than that. And so finding out about all of these things, you realize that a lot of people in Southern California are either not aware of or not prepared for that big of a disaster, and it's inevitable. And so that really informed our tone of seriousness. And we wanted to supplement that at the same time with something positive and lighthearted and very much practical in nature. And that's why we have the tips at the end of the episodes. But we felt like people wouldn't want to prepare unless they knew what they were dealing with. And we felt like if people only were afraid, they wouldn't actually be willing or able to prepare because they'd be overwhelmed. So we had to kind of, you know, create a yin yang type of situation.
So how has your audience responded to the show?
We've had so many people reach out with their earthquake kits, their earthquake plans, conversations that they've had with their significant others, their neighbors, their family members. On Twitter alone, we've seen, you know, from people sending us pictures of water bottles that they've filled up and put in different parts of their houses, to people like Sean T from the Insanity video series preparing for the inevitable earthquake. So it's been a huge outpouring of support and response and preparation. And I think we've been blown away by the impact of the show.
And what about you? You told me earlier that you're not from LA originally. You said you weren't necessarily taking earthquake risk seriously before producing this show. What's changed for you now that you have?
So what's kind of funny is, one, that I grew up in Pakistan, which is also earthquake country, but that's the kind of place where, like, if an earthquake strikes, you run out of the building because most buildings will probably collapse. So there's not much preparation we'll do because the infrastructure is not there. So I grew up kind of ignoring the risk. And then moving to Southern California, you know, I kind of had the same mentality. And then preparing for the show and putting the show together, you kind of get desensitized to this thing that you're constantly reporting on, talking to people about, because otherwise you can't emotionally handle what you're dealing with and actually produce a show. And so for me, it wasn't until the Ridgecrest earthquakes just a couple weeks ago that I put together my earthquake kit for my partner and I.
Yeah. So tell me about, did you feel the Ridgecrest earthquakes down there in L.A.?
Yeah, I'm on the east side of Los Angeles, which is definitely more earthquake prone and closer to San Andreas. But yeah, we were at a restaurant in Highland Park when the bigger 7.1 earthquake happened right outside of a bar in a brick building. And so I freaked out because we didn't have a table near us to get under. And I know brick buildings are notoriously bad, and it just went on forever. So I was like, this must be a big one. The first one, I was at home, so that was a little less scary of a situation.
Wow, but you were, there was no way to know that it was sent, that the epicenter was so far away from LA. So of course your mind went to this could be it.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, and the only thing that I knew from seismologists was that if it goes on for a long time, that means that it's a really big earthquake. And what I found out, in talking to Lucy Jones again recently, is that if it feels like jerky, fast motion shaking for a really long time, then the epicenter is near you. But if it goes on for a really long time and it's slow rolling motion, then the epicenter is probably very far. It probably still is a very big earthquake, but you're not too close to it.
How interesting. And so how did producing the show influence your reporting on the Ridgecrest earthquakes? Because you did some of that down for KPCC as well.
I think the thing that I have realized is that people really want to know what's going on because they're afraid of uncertainty, and earthquakes, are random and you can't really predict them. You may be able to give statistical probabilities of the likelihood of an earthquake of a certain magnitude or intensity happening in a particular part of the country, but you still can't tell people this is when it'll happen, this is what it's going to be like. And so what I've learned is the more information you can give them, the closer you can get to certainty, the better, and the more practical things you can do that you can give them to do, the better it is too, because in the absence of information, they can occupy their minds and their time with something to do like preparing. So in reporting on the Ridgecrest earthquake and kind of putting together this special episode of The Big One, we are again emphasizing the things that people can do to put their hearts and mind at ease in the wake of these big ones.
Well, speaking of which, as you said, in The Big One, you come in kind of at the end of every episode with some lightweight tips and pointers. Can you share, some of your favorites, maybe some of the ones that stood out the most to you?
Yeah, I think the most important is get food and water everywhere. So there's like a myth about earthquakes, like other disasters, that you need a go bag. But most likely you won't be going anywhere in an earthquake. You're probably going to be staying put. And so you want to make sure that you have water in probably every corner of the house, but at least in one part of your house, some water and food in your car. And then the big one that I have realized is that because cell service will be down, you probably want to get a long range walkie-talkie if you have the money to buy one. And that will allow you to communicate with loved ones. Another one is to not hang anything above your bed because the earthquake might strike in the middle of the night and you don't want something to fall on top of you. You want to keep shoes under your bed so that when the earthquake does strike, if it is in the middle of the night, you don't walk on glass or broken objects and injure yourself. The most important one is when the shaking does happen, please do not get in a doorway. Drop, cover, and hold on. Get under a table. That's the safest possible thing you can do.
Fantastic. Well, Misha Youssef is a reporter and producer at KPCC and the lead producer of the podcast, The Big One. Misha, thanks so much.
Thank you. Thanks so much for having me.
And for the weekend, Valley Public Radio's David Aus spoke with Grammy Award-winning trombonist Jamie Dubberly about upcoming summer concerts and the CSU Summer Arts course he's coordinating in Afro-Caribbean jazz.
Welcome.
Thanks. Great to be here.
Great to have you with us. So, Jamie, you're originally from coastal Georgia.
That's right.
And I want to first start by asking how you caught the fever of Afro-Caribbean jazz.
I was a music major at the University of Georgia. I was a classical performance major. I played mostly bass trombone, and I was doing the classical music audition scene. And then I went to graduate school in the Hart School of Music in Hartford, Connecticut. At that school, leading the jazz program was Jackie McLean, great saxophonist, iconic, you know, alto saxophonist, and incredible jazz program happening there. That's the first time I ever was really exposed or had any experience playing in a Latin band. And a trumpet player, a friend of mine, said, why don't you, they need a trombone player for this merengue and salsa band. Why don't you come check it out? So I'm like, okay. I remember that the first half of the rehearsal was probably the longest hour of my life. I was completely lost for the first hour of rehearsal because I couldn't figure out where the downbeat was.
Exactly.
Because the bass was not playing on the downbeat. You know, we're used to, and even in jazz music, you feel the one, the down, the one, two, three, four, one. You know, it's like somebody's playing there. And this music, nobody was playing there. And I was
completely out of your depth.
Yeah, it was pretty, but I thought it was really cool. Unbelievably, they actually hired me for a gig, that band. They were desperate, I think.
Well, and this gets to kind of the heart of Afro-Caribbean music, which is the groove, the beat.
Right.
And that groove, it's not just the beat of the music, it's the beat of life.
Yes.
For Afro-Caribbean music,
right.
Is the name of the course that you're coordinating at Summer Arts, Clave.
The Clave. Right.
Can you talk to us a little bit about Clave?
Sure, sure. It's a word that has got a couple of definitions. It's not only is it the heartbeat of the music, it's also the instrument, the two wooden sticks that are played together that play that pattern. And it's a rhythmic pattern that is just the foundation of so many Afro-Caribbean styles and different variations of it. But it's just like we have the backbeat, you know, in jazz and rock and funk and most American styles. The two and the four, where it's where we feel the beat in Cuban and Puerto Rican and Afro-Caribbean music, we feel that pulse with the clave.
Yeah. The people uninitiated to Afro-Caribbean music, if you're an American rock listener,
right,
you've heard clave your whole life and not known it.
That's right.
Most clearly in, we call it the Bo Diddley beat.
Yes, yes. It's funny, I was just... right before I came over here, I was talking to the students, and we have a morning history class, and we were discussing that the music that we grew up with in America is actually the influence of Latin music, like you said, is the rock and roll in the 60s, those chord progressions, the beat, it all comes from Cuba.
So one of the great things about being a student in Summer Arts is you get to combine the best elements of musical education along with getting those experiences that are harder for younger musicians to get today, which is learning on the bandstand.
Yes.
Learning live with experienced players. In
right.
Summer Arts, all those elements come together.
Yes.
So there's theory and application happening every day.
Yes.
Day in, day out, and into the night, and
yes.
all that. For the students, it culminates in a student performance. Are your students, are they learning, will they be reading charts? Are they going to learn some grooves that they're playing?
Actually, part of my idea for the course is that I wanted to bring in an arranging element, so all the students will be working on in their smaller groups on an arranging project together, which they will, I think, hopefully be performing their arrangement on the concert on the 27th. And the other music they'll be playing are arrangements that I have, and also... some arrangements out of a book called The Latin Real Book.
In addition to the student concert, which is on Saturday the 27th, 7:30 p.m. at the Fresno State Concert Hall, there's an artist performance as well, which takes place next Wednesday, July 24th, 7 p.m. at Fresno State Concert Hall.
Right.
Who's going to be playing on it?
That concert, we will be joined by Doug Beavers, who's a trombonist from New York, one of the top voices on the trombone in both jazz and Latin music, lives in New York, plays with the Eddie Palmieri Orchestra, plays with Spanish Harlem Orchestra, has his own projects that last year was nominated for a Grammy called The Art of the Arrangement. He's leading the arranging workshop, so this is an incredible opportunity for the students to work with one of the top arrangers in this music, Doug Beavers. We're also joined by Mr. John Santos, who's an absolute iconic percussionist and historian from the San Francisco Bay Area, and I think has been a part of this CSU Summer Arts in the past, and we're so thrilled to have him coming present lectures and also working with the students, percussion and working with the ensembles. And so those gentlemen will be joined by our sort of in-house faculty that are here for the entire time, which include bass player named Ernesto Mazar Kendilan, a Cuban bass player living in the Bay Area now, also a young man named Eric Peralta, who's from Peru and is a relatively recent graduate of Berklee School of Music. And then on percussion, we have two great percussionists, Mr. Brian Andres, who's a young man from Cincinnati, Ohio. He's working with the big students right now, teaching beginning percussion. The non-percussionists, the horn players, the bass players, they're all learning percussion. And also Mr. Carlos Caro, who's another Cuban musician who lives in Modesto, California.
For someone who's new to this music, mm-hmm. what's the first thing they should listen to?
I would say maybe start with Tito Puente. Tito Puente and Machito and his Afro-Cubans, yep, from the 40s and 50s. That's where the music that as we know it kind of today evolved from, the New York City scene in the 1940s and 50s.
What's the hardest thing for students learning in this genre?
I think the importance of listening, the importance of listening to absorb the feeling of the music.
Yeah, and it gets to something deeper that summer arts is all about, which is giving an immersive experience, not just for students, but for the community. So for everyone, even if you're not a student or a creative type, if you just go and enjoy any of the events that Summer Arts is putting on, you're getting an immersive experience and you will come away a different person with a different outlook on how creation informs our humanity and can transform the world and communities we live in.
Absolutely. Every morning we've been talking about the previous performance, the evening, and how that relates to what we're doing and the creative process. So, absolutely.
Jamie Dubberly is the course coordinator for the course at CSU Summer Arts, the Clave, performing Afro-Caribbean jazz, next Wednesday, July 24th at 7 p.m. at the Fresno State Concert Hall. There's going to be a great concert with special guests, including trombonist Doug Beavers and percussionist John Santos. And then on Saturday, July 27th, 7:30 p.m. at the Fresno State Concert Hall, we'll get to hear the students in Yay. This course perform and share everything that they've learned.
And that's today's Valley Edition. You can hear all this and more on our website, kvpr.org. You can also download the podcast and find us on Twitter and Facebook.
Don't forget to check out our app. It's called KVPR, and it's available for free on iTunes and Android. The show is produced by the KVPR News Team. Alice Daniel, Monica Velez,
Carrie Klein, and Laura Satsui. Technical support from Marv Allen and Don Weaver. I'm Alice Daniel.
And I'm Carrie Klein. This has been Valley Edition. Thanks for listening.
Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, committed to a California where all low-income workers have the power to advance economically. Learn more at irvine.org. The California Endowment. Health happens when Californians value schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org. And by the California Healthcare Foundation, helping low-income Californians get the healthcare they need. On the web at chcf.org.